had a planned meeting anyway in Kazakhstan for the next manned launch. So the NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstine, and the Russian, Dmitry, I think it's Rogozin, he's going to meet him, and they're going to discuss this. Apparently, NASA's not too happy. Dmitry Rogozin decided about a week or so ago to say that this hole could have been drilled by one of the astronauts. Definitely a hole that was drilled, but the astronauts were not happy to hear that possibility. So they're going to have a conversation about that, I think, and hopefully Bridenstine straightens the Russians out on this mess that they're talking about. You know, they have to worry about other holes. Who put this hole there? Are there any holes that are left that they haven't found that there's glue stuck in that will eventually, you know, break apart? Our future spacecraft going to go up with holes in it? So things have to all be worked out, and that won't happen until October. Actually, October 10th at Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. That's where they launch all the Soyuz rockets from. So, drop it, see if anybody has any questions so far. Okay, last week, as it was getting late, there was supposed to be a launch from Cape Canaveral, and it was delayed. It was going to go off at like 11:28 at night, Dirtanet. Full at 11:30. It was delayed about an hour due to weather down in Florida. But it did take off. It was a Falcon 9 booster, one of the new Block 5 versions. That's one of the ones that are going to be reusable up to 10 different times before they refurbish it, and then they'll be able to do that over and over again, so up to 100 times it will be able to fly. Unlike the Block 4 version, which could fly twice, and then they would scrap it. Block 5 is their newer version. This is the fifth time they've flown a Block 5. So quite successful. It got off the ground that night. And it landed in a barge around 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean. The satellite was being put up for Asia. That was successfully completed by the second stage. Merlin engine, the Merlin D engine, to complete that part of the mission. But this 157-foot, 12-foot diameter booster came back and landed right on the deck out in the middle of the ocean, and then they brought it all back. We talked about the legs last week, the landing legs. And I mentioned that they were 60 feet apart, and Dick was wondering about that particular distance. Talked about you know, the length of his house, and you know, and it turns out most houses in America, these landing legs would span that distance. There's four landing legs. When it comes down, it's right before it lands, like maybe 20 seconds before it lands on a barge. These legs pop open, and they expand to a distance of 60 feet from one end to the other. So I finally found a really good picture of what this thing looks like as it's coming back, and it's in Port Canaveral. And I put it on, I sent it to Roy, and I also sent it to Dick. And I believe Roy has a chance, might be able to put it onto his website, Roy at AC2GS.com. Very good picture, and if you look at it, blow the picture up, you can see it standing, sitting on it on this barge with the legs sticking out. Let me drop it. And if you blow the picture up, you know, two or three different levels, you can see there's three workers working at the bottom of the rocket, and they look like teeny tiny little people, and you get a good idea of the distance of these legs and how massive this thing is. Any questions? I'm wondering if Roy's going to, I think he's going to have to cut and paste to do it. I didn't send it directly to Mike. I sent it in an email. Let me drop it.
Paul, how long ago did you mail that to me? because I don't know if I've gotten it.
Well, it was on a return trip. Roy sends out sometimes a list of some of the topics that he's going to send out, and then I had replied to all on that, so it should have gone to Roy, and it should have gone to you. I don't know. If not, I'll just resend it to you, Dick. Roy, did you get this?
Yeah, I got it, and it's up on the website. You just, anyone interested, just type roy.ac2gs.com, and it's sitting there in all its beauty, and you can see the little tiny itsy-bitsy people at the base.
Yeah, that's quite a sight. And the height is, you gotta remember, it's 12 feet in diameter, but the height is 157 feet. So I think of people with big towers, like Dick's got, I don't know, 80 or 100 foot tower or something. Call it a 100 foot tower. Add another 57 feet on that and make it a 12 foot diameter thing, and you get a good idea of what this thing must look like as it's coming back from outer space. Any comments?
Put an antenna on the top of it.
Yeah, actually they do. They have antennas on top. They have cameras on board. But yeah, that would be a good thing to have in your backyard. Yeah, that's a good idea, Dick. Now, Dick could go over to Roy at ac2gs.com and bring that up. Do you have to put something in? There's a million choices on your website. Do you have to put in, Falcon 9 legs or something? Something's going to get you there.
No, it's a tippy top. Every time I put stuff in, it goes to the top. So the new stuff is on the top, the old stuff is farther down. So if anyone keys it in, the very first item is your picture.
Oh, okay, that's a good idea. Very good. And those legs are reusable. Now they just fold them up. The Block 4 version, they used to have to remove the legs, and they were pretty much toast. And these are all reusable. They beefed them up so they had less of a chance of them collapsing. They had a couple of those incidents where it would come down hard and it would bend and the whole thing would tip over, blow up on a barge. By the way, these things come back to land too. They come back to a landing zone in Cape Canaveral. It's called Landing Zone 1. It used to be Launch Complex 13. They used to launch rockets from there. They stripped everything out and they put this big concrete circle with a big X in it. That's the SpaceX. And they're doing a launch that doesn't usually involve the geosynchronous orbit, a lighter payload. They'll bring the booster and they'll fly right back to Cape Canaveral. And they don't have to land it on a barge and take 2 days to bring it back. So, and then you might remember last February they had the heavy Falcon Heavy launch. And that was three boosters, and on top of the center booster they had the second stage, and that launched Elon Musk's Tesla car into Earth orbit toward Mars. But that's because nobody wanted to gamble and put their payload on top, and he was doing it as a test, first time that ever went up. Well, they were made up of all Block 4 boosters, so actually two of those boosters, the port and starboard side, the center core was new, but the other two were previously flown boosters that put satellites or even the Dragon spacecraft up to the International Space Station. They took those spare boosters, attached them to the center core booster, and that's what the configuration was of that. And those two port and starboard pieces actually came back to Florida. That's what everybody got to see. They landed exactly at the same time at Launch Complex, old Launch Complex 13 now, as they call it, Landing Zone 1, so they had to have two big concrete circles now with X's painted in the middle, and they landed both right on the money. Fly independently. Years ago, they wouldn't be able to do that because they would use radar and they would, you know, when they had a launch, the radar would look at one vehicle and check on it as it was going up, make sure it was going off course, and if it was going off course, somebody in the control room would blow it up and save everybody on Earth. Now they don't have to worry about those radars anymore. They've done away with the islands at Merritt Island facilities. They've done away with the radars. Now they have internal guidance is perfected on these boosters. When they both go up, they're independent of each other, and they come back and they land independent. And that's why they looked like it was almost animation as they were coming back. They were set up with internal guidance on each booster. That was pretty cool. The center booster was supposed to land on the autonomous drone ship. It didn't make it. It ran out of TTEP, which is that's the fuel that mixes together, that ignites or instantaneously. It doesn't need a spark plug, you know, and it creates this little green explosion below the rocket, and that reignites the Merlin engines as it's coming down. They ran out of that as it was coming down, and it just crashed into the ocean.
Paul, I've got the picture that I think you're talking about. It's on Roy's page, AC2GS, roy.ac2gs.com. And when I looked at the SpaceX craft sitting on, I guess, the barge, I can see the charred marks on the side of the booster fuselage, so to speak. I see the charred marks where the legs folded up, where they originally were stored on the way down. Are you telling me those charred marks from the base of the craft to the top of the chart, are you telling me that is a 60-foot distance? Because if I then paste that off on the height of the whole spacecraft, I would come up with 180 feet. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Yeah, from the, from, let's say, one leg to the center of the booster, about 30 feet. So two of them together is 60 feet. So you got, if you blow it up, you see those little people there, right at the base, working, there's three guys. And, the booster's 157 feet high, so if your tower's 100 feet, right? So add 57 feet to your tower, and that's how big this thing is. And this is the first stage. Above that, you've got the second stage, and that's in outer space. That don't come back.
Okay, so each of those legs are 30 feet long, and if there's four of them and they stick out the four sides, you get a 60-foot base. Now I understand. So those charred marks on the side of the booster, from the base to the top of that charred mark where it used to be before it folded out, the leg folded out, that's 30 feet high. That makes more sense, with a great big yellow crane behind us. Okay, Paul, thank you. You don't have to send it to me here. Roy already did. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, that yellow crane is going to swing over. You can't see the top of the booster in this picture, but they'll put these big bull rings on, these big slings and nylon slings, and they'll attach to it, and they'll pick up that whole thing. Before they put it down horizontally, they'll fold up those legs and at some point, and they'll be able to reuse it. They've already done that successfully with this new Block 5. And it's charred, yeah, from the two reasons. One, got the re-entry, the boost back first, and then the re-entry burn. So it gets a little hot coming down. And then right at the very end, the landing itself, the flames are hitting that deck and coming back up, surrounding it. So it's kind of charred on the bottom a little bit. And that's one of the improvements they did with the Block 5. They installed on the very bottom. See, you're looking at the nine engines are right at the very bottom. So right above the nine engines, they put a heat shield protecting all the plumbing and all the wiring. That tended to get damaged on the Block 4 version. They'd take it back in and repair it and bring it back to McGregor, Texas, where they test these things, make sure it was okay, and then they would bring it back to Florida or Vandenberg Air Force Base in California and relaunch. We drop it. So that was one of the improvements. More carbon involved with the legs now. It's still really an aluminum honeycomb frame for those legs that pop out. Made some other improvements. The interstage between the second stage and the first stage is now, you can see it is black. So again, that's more carbon involved there. And the whole exterior is painted with some kind of a heat-resisting type paint, so they don't have to. If you look at the landings of the Block 4 versions, ones before that, it was pretty charred all the way up. I mean, you know, they would clean it up a little bit, but when it was relaunching, you could see it was a used booster. So that's the story on that. I wanted to put that on Roy's website. And roy.at2gs.com. I keep saying at an email. So, okay. I just want to make one other comment. They do land in Florida. Well, they haven't landed yet in Vandenberg Air Force Base on land yet, but they're getting ready. I think it's the next Iridium mission. They're going to try to bring the booster back to land instead of landing on the autonomous ship barge out in the Pacific Ocean. You know, they'll be bringing that back to land. They have the pad ready to go, and it's not like they land on the same launch pad that they take off from. The one in Florida, it's about 2.5 miles away from the launch complex itself, either Launch Complex 40 or Launch Complex 39A, which is the two that they have in Florida. But they have another one in California as well that they launch from. So that's the story. I'm looking forward to tomorrow's news. You got to look for tomorrow's news somewhere along the line if you can avoid the politics. That's on all the time. And then a story about the hurricane. But SpaceX is supposed to be making an announcement of a name, a person that has signed up to take a trip around the moon on one of Elon Musk's rockets. You might remember a couple years ago, it was actually 2017, early 2017, that they made an announcement that two people were going to take a ride in a Dragon spacecraft. Going to launch from a Falcon Heavy spacecraft, and it was going to go around the moon, and then they were going to come back. Was it going to land? They never revealed those two people's names, and since then they've decided to not human rate the Falcon Heavy. That's the one with the three boosters. So although the regular Falcon, that's going to be the standard rocket that will send crews up to the space station, that will be human rated, but the Heavy no more has been canceled. They're going to keep launching those Heavies with satellites, but no people. That was a long-term plan for Elon Musk. Now, that has changed. He said he's making a lot of headway with the BFR, they call it the Big Falcon Rocket, is what they're calling it. I like the original name, Mars Colony Transport, but they changed that to another name called the ITS, the Interplanetary Transport System. Now they've changed it to another name called the BFR, Big Falcon Rocket. I've got to remember how to say that. I've got to be careful. Okay, so that is going to be the rocket that this person has signed up for. It's going to pay Elon Musk to get into this thing and take off and go around the moon. They make it seem like this is going to happen like within a year or so. They haven't even launched a BFR yet. They haven't even launched one of the new engines, these Raptor engines. I keep talking about the Merlin D engines that they have. They're all called Merlin engines. Each one of their engine on a Falcon 9 is called a Merlin D engine. Now they're going to have the Raptor engines, more powerful. They're not going to run on kerosene like your standard rocket. They're going to run on liquid methane and liquid oxygen. But one of these rockets has not even launched yet. I know he's working on it for a real oxygen tank that they had. It was a massive thing. Tested that. I think they're still a long way from actually launching one of these things. I hope not. The sooner the better as far as I'm concerned. But this is what he plans on doing. And he's apparently got somebody that signed their name, and they're going to announce tomorrow guy's name. That's what I want to see. Let's see what they say about this this launch. If you see it on the news, you'll know what they're talking about. This is WS2N.
What's your guess as to what that single passenger, is there going to be a passenger plus a pilot going around the moon? What's your guess as to what that passenger paid for that ride, Paul?
I don't know. Give you an idea. To launch a satellite just on a Falcon 9 rocket, $62 million. $62 million to put your satellite into orbit, geosynchronous orbit, or whatever you're going to do with it. To launch the International Space Station with the cargo, I'm sure it's more than that. That's what they've been doing. To put a person on board, I don't even know what the cost of. They're going to send their crews of four up to the International Space Station, and they say they're going to beat the Russians. The Russians are already up to charging the United States like almost $80 million dollars now. They want per astronaut. So they say he's going to beat those prices, but I don't think by much. So I'm going to guess two people. Probably an astronaut and whoever this guy is. Once he gets above the common line, he'll be an astronaut too. So at least two people, and I'm going to say $80 million each. And I'll pick a number. Hopefully it's less, because we got to get less than the Russians. So let's go with $75 million. Back to you, Zach.
Nice big number. Now, are they going to just do one figure eight around the moon, or is it going to be a little bit like Apollo 8, where they go into a deorbit burn? In other words, they go into a translunar injection, go to the moon, and then a lunar orbit injection burn, make some number of loops around the moon, and then come back to the Earth. So is it just one great big figure eight, or a number of loops around the moon, Paul? What's your guess, K2RIW?
Yeah, I've read nothing about it. I mean, if you're going to go by the old system, when they were going to go up on a Crew Dragon vehicle on the Falcon Heavy, that they were just going to make a figure eight and come back. So that would be Apollo 8, not like an Apollo. Apollo 8 went into, 10 orbits, and then they came back. So, this is going to be more like probably an Apollo 13, where they actually used the moon to come back safely. They had one figure eight back. But I don't know. First of all, they've got to launch this rocket unmanned to make sure everything works. And then I'm sure they'll be able to eventually man it. And they'll be in Earth orbit. It'll go into Earth orbit and come back. His plans for the BFR. See, he's got this complex. He's building a launch complex in near Brownsville, Texas. Building it now. And his goal is to launch these things suborbitally. Let me drop it. So on a BFR, you're going to have a booster with seven, it used to be six, now it's seven of these Raptor wrenches, these big liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines. He wants to launch the second half, which is really the equivalent of the second stage vehicle, but let's call it the second stage and spaceship at the same time. In other words, like launching a rocket that has a booster, have the booster come back and land, you know, by itself, and then eventually have the second stage, which is really part of the spaceship, come back and land. So he plans on going down to near Brownsville, Texas, and he plans on launching suborbitally. He's going to launch them up and come down and launch up, down. And that's how he's going to get started. Let me drop it.
Let me ask this question. He calls this vehicle the three-letter abbreviation BFR, Baker Foxtrot Romeo. Is that a tongue-in-cheek name where you know that those three letters have a possible interpretation? That's pretty strong language. Over you, Paul.
I agree, Dick. That's why I said I got to be careful how I say this on amateur radio. You know, I don't like the name. I like the ITS. They call it the Interplanetary Transportation System, because he wants to use it to go everywhere, Moon, Mars, and other locations. He wants to, you know, this is going to go around the solar system. Okay. But, I mean, I like the original name, the Mars Colonial Transport. That was good. Should have stuck with that.
But as you know, my belief is that for a long period of time, I believe we're not going to send a human being to the surface of Mars for a whole bunch of reasons. I just don't think that's going to take place. To go to Mars is 1,000 times more difficult than going to the moon. And the moon was $33 billion in 1970 money. So cost-wise, human safety-wise, real reason. I mean, if a human being in an ideal spacesuit is standing on the surface of Mars, to a science fiction writer, that sounds very desirable. What in the world is he going to do when he gets there? Not a chance is he going to be the beginning of a colony. Not a chance is he going to be self-sustaining. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, and you need more infrastructure to get there. And that means bigger landing vehicles, and going through the atmosphere is not easy, which brings me to this other topic that they have here of trying to make a big heat shield. They've developed a couple of things where they inflate this big heat shield, and that's going to, you know, give them a bigger diameter, so you're going to be able to bring heavier loads and bigger pieces of equipment back to Mars. But now they've developed another one. This one looks like an umbrella, and it's got carbon fiber with it, woven into it. It almost looks like a million threads going around and around, and then this actuates, and the thing pops open like an umbrella. So they plan on putting this on these landing vehicles. So you come down with a 20-foot diameter thing, and then pop this thing open, and all of a sudden you're going to have, you know, 40 feet of diameter, and you're going to be able to have a heavier load come down to Mars. So they're developing this thing, and they just a couple of days ago they launched one from New Mexico. We have a spaceport in Mexico called the Spaceport America. That's the name of this thing, Spaceport America. Big millions of acres of property in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico, and they have launch facilities there. So there's this company, UP Aerospace, and they've been testing their rockets there. They're not orbital. They do get into space. They get around 80 miles up or so. So NASA contracted with these guys. Let me drop it. And just the other day, it's a beautiful rocket. Just the other day, they launched this successfully up, above the atmosphere, and then had to come down and want to make sure this actuator would work and this big umbrella thing would open up. It's not that big. This is a proof of concept type of thing. It looks like about, I don't know, 6 feet or something, maybe 5 feet in diameter when it opens up. It launched on this relatively small rocket. One of these, there's a lot of companies that are launching rockets, but this UP Aerospace is doing pretty good. They launched quite a few rockets from from New Mexico. But that, these are the things they work on. You know, if they could develop something big enough and strong enough to withstand the heat, yeah, maybe they can get something down to the planet 10 years from now, maybe. But, yeah, you know, they got a long way to go, Dick.
Long way to go is an understatement, Paul. The moon is a quarter, a little more than a quarter of a million miles away. At the time that you land on Mars, you're going to be 300 million miles away from the Earth. I may be conservative when I say getting to Mars is almost 1,000 times more difficult. Booster power, light, length of journey, miles involved, almost everything is 1,000 times more difficult than the moon. And moon was $33 billion in 1970 money. So affording it, surviving it, enough hardware to go that distance, it's a much more difficult planet to deorbit from and get onto the surface. I'm having trouble believing that you and my grandchildren are going to see a human being standing on Mars or Pole. Go ahead.
I'll be happy to see somebody on the moon. You know, Eugene Cernan, he just died a year or so ago. Last man to walk on the moon. He was really bent on having somebody go back to the moon. He really wanted somebody to land there and say, you know, okay, we did what you wanted. Because, you know, one of his last statements was talking about bringing people back to the moon after he left. But not going to happen for a while. I mean, you know, the Russians are planning it. They're probably 15, 20 years away from landing somebody back on the moon, I think. Even India's got plans. They have a manned capsule now. They haven't launched anybody into space, but I think within 5 years they're going to have somebody in orbit. So, taking up vitamins, maybe we'll live to see it. K2RI, WWS.
In the case of the Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17 missions that did put two men on the moon for up to two and a half days, you can put a man on the surface of the moon on a particular spot for a couple of days. You can't leave him there any longer than that. I'm not talking about running out of oxygen, running out of fuel. I'm just talking about surviving the temperatures on the moon. High noon on the moon is 200 and some odd degrees centigrade. Midnight on the moon is something like minus 150 degrees centigrade. You can't survive the temperatures of the moon, no matter how good your air conditioning system is. So you can put a man standing on the moon and with the right space suit and craft and everything else, a couple of days. Why do that? If he can only be there for a couple of days, he can gather some rocks and bring them back home. What else can he really do there, Paul? I'm having trouble believing it can be financed once you realize this temperature problem that's never mentioned in any of the newspaper articles we read. Over to you, Paul. KQRIW.
Yeah, well, whoever sets up the first base there, you know, that's, again, that's competition, you know. And everybody's going to want to do it, and I think we should do it first. And a lot of things that you do don't find out how useful it is until after it's done. I read a book, Artemis, about a base on the moon. It was a pretty good book. It was okay. Gives you a good idea of, you know, what could be going on. They could be digging up the water that they found on the moon. They say there's enough water equivalent to what's in the Mediterranean Sea. You could dig that up and utilize that. You know, our breathing equipment, breathing fuel, hydrogen fuel equipment on the moon to run, you know, make power, you know, with fuel cells. You are going to need nuclear power, there's no question about it. You're definitely going to need solar panels. You're going to need a little bit of everything. I guess the only thing that's not going to work is wind power. And then you could take it from there, naturally develop it to the point where you could bring people up, and people are willing to pay a fortune to not only fly around the moon, but could you imagine what they, in the beginning, what they would be willing to pay to land on the moon? You know, these people with no more money than they know what to do with. You know, in the beginning, it would definitely be tourism.
Back to you, Dick.
Back up here, Paul. You said putting a base on the moon. What in the world is a base? I mean, I'm going to let you construct something that can be called a astronaut habitable structure. I'm going to let you build it as big as your house. I'm going to let you have all the hardware that you can land that base on the moon. Where in the moon? Where on the moon are you going to put it? As the 28-day period of the moon takes place, and your base is sitting at high noon, it's at 150 degrees centigrade outside temperature with the sun beating down on you. Can't tolerate that. And then at midnight, it's going to be minus 200 and some odd degrees. If your base was, let me pick a number, if it was 100 meters below the surface, where the temperature is more constant, maybe. But your base, I don't think there's any geographic place on the moon where you can place a base where it will survive with human beings inside. Over to you, Paul, KQIW.
Yeah, well, you've got Shackleton Crater, that's on the south pole. I'd go there first, a lot more daylight. Definitely bring a lot of nukes. You've got to be able to create a tremendous amount of refrigeration. You've got to be able to supply heat in the wintertime. So, you know, you're going to need a base. All right. Let's call it a colony. Let's go bigger than a base. You can go up to the middle of the moon where you don't have to excavate the moon to live on the ground. They have lava tubes so you can put, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people in this lava tubes. Maybe they could work on that system. But, you know, that's the ultimate goal is to have a permanent location on the moon and people there all the time. You know, that's what everybody is really striving for. Not, you know, instead of going 3 days like we did with final missions of Apollo. So, you know, we're talking about a long time from now. Originally, you've got to set up temporary quarters down there and build from there. Look at the South Pole. I mean, they had that one geocentric dome, you know, all the for decades there, and that's all gone now. But, you know, you had people living there, a small amount of people during the winter. Then,
hold on, Paul. You talked about summer and winter on the moon. The moon is going to give you the hottest possible summer you can imagine once every 14 days. It's going to give you the coldest possible winter you can possibly imagine another 14 days later.
Repeater, timeout.
Those temperatures are not survivable. Yeah, but the craters at the North Pole and the South Pole, now you've got tremendously cold temperature all the time. Very little sunlight. It's only just tipping over the horizon. So setting up solar cells there is not easy. So the degree of difficulty of having a human being in any kind of a habitat survive on the surface of the moon, let's say anywhere near the equator, for one 28-day period, having them survive that is a huge endeavor. I mean, the world's most perfect air conditioning, to get that plus 150 degrees centigrade down to something you can tolerate, 30 degrees centigrade, the slightest hiccup on that air conditioning, and you're cooked, literally cooked. And the same thing when it comes to the cold. And the degree of difficulty and the cost is so high, and what do you get in return? You've got a guy in a hut on the moon with the world's most perfect air conditioner and heater, nuclear-powered, maybe a bunch of solar cells outside. And what is he going to do there, Paul? Over to you, KQIW.
It goes back to what I said years ago. As long as he's a ham radio operator and sets up his 80-meter dipole, I'll be happy. You know, I can work him. Get a QSL card from there. I know I'm running out of time, so. But, hey, you know, you're going to have hams on the moon. There's no question about it. They stay for a short period of time. Maybe they'll make some contacts. Definitely going to have them in orbit. That will be first. They're going to have the gateway, they call it. series of modules, eventually able to live there for, they're predicting around 40 days at a time. So that's the present plan. I think next year they're going to be giving out contracts for these different modules. And then from there, work your way down to the moon. And they'll have short stays in the beginning, like anything else, but eventually it will be longer. Just like I was saying about the South Pole, they now have, in their winter time, it's dark all the time, you can't even fly planes in and out anymore, and they have around 40 or 50 people living full-time in the South Pole. In the summer, their summertime, you have hundreds, like 200, 300, 400 people there, and they're living in these buildings that are above the ice. They're able to raise the building up hydraulically. That one little dome that they used to have gone. So it's making progress as the days go on. To our IWWS.
McMurdo Station, or whatever, the station we got at the South Pole is pretty severe, summer versus winter. Winter is pretty severe and dark. But that's like a day in Florida compared to the moon, Paul, on a 28-day lunar stay on the surface. So make a guess for me. How many years from now do you think we will be able to place a man on the surface of the moon and keep him there for one complete lunar day, 28 days, 28 Earth days? How soon do you think that can happen, Paul? I don't think we can do that in 20 years. Over to you.
Yeah, I'll be happy if we get people back to the moon in 10. And then, you know, it's going to be, you know, you're going to have the gateway, and then eventually you're going to get people down to the surface. So, you're a long way off from that. And, unfortunately, you know, it might take 20 years for a full 28-day cycle. Once they do it, it'll be like anything else, you know. They add to it, and that's it. It's running out of time. What are you going to do? Back to you, Dick.
Paul, tell me the mechanism by which a man on the surface of the moon in some kind of a habitat is going to survive one 28-day Earth Day period. How is he going to survive one single lunar day?
Probably under the ground. You know, they're going to have to excavate. And that's what I'm saying. You're going to have a lot of landings, and they're going to leave. And Bigelow wants to put those inflatables on the moon's surface. He thinks those things are so insulated that, you know, you'll have so much inside the living quarters, you'll be trying to get rid of it, like they do in the space station. So that would be the daytime. Nighttime is going to be a problem. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I've made my point. How skeptical I am about this. When Buzz Aldrin tells us we should go back on the moon, he doesn't get into any of these details of that huge temperature swing. That we've never put a man there more than a couple of days. And to build a habitat below the surface, again, those words roll off the tongue real easily. How in the world do you do that when you can only stay there for a couple of days at a time? You guys just heard TechNet number 1716, Space Report number 316, and Science Report number 45. We'll be back next week. We'll solve some of these lunar problems and some of these other problems that we are starting to hear about of people being bathed in microwave radiation at Puerto Rico, which there's an awful lot of unknowns there. 73, you all. Paul has probably already said his 73s. Roy, any final comments, Roy? What's your guess as to how many puzzles you have next time? AC2GS for a final, K2RIW. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. It is AC2GS. I don't know if there's going to be puzzles next week. It depends. We'll see what happens. I get people's feedback on, again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. Whether you like puzzles, don't like puzzles, what kind of puzzles, subjects you want, subjects you don't want, all manner of things. And go to the website, because it's all posted already, roy.ac2gs.com. And the quote for tonight, if we were making TechNet t-shirts, would be correlation is not causation. Words to live by. So I want to thank everyone who participated or listened. Great weekend. We'll all be back to do this all over again next week. This is AC2GS and 73, everyone.
And say it one more time. Correlation is not...
Correlation is not causation. Yeah, I even put a link up on the page for that.
Beautiful statement. Thank you. Bye-bye, you all. See you guys next week.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
L. Repeater system. Amateur Radio Repeater System.